Good evening and welcome to the 10th and final installment this semester of Let's Rock and Roll. I'm your host, DJ Treble, and I can't wait for my classic soul to share some classic rock knowledge with you all this Monday night, tonight on radio.dominican.edu, the official radio station of Dominican University of California. Each week, I will be telling you all about a legendary band from the classic rock era. We're talking 60s and 70s here. They'll have the baby boomers feeling nostalgic and the newer generations ready to discover something old, yet something brand new. This week, we'll be jamming together to the Holy Triumvirate of Progressive Rock, Rush. Alright, I'm going to give you guys a warning before we begin the show. Rush is my favorite band of all time. I will choose this band over any band, any day, if I had to listen to one band for the rest of my entire existence. On repeat, this is the band. I love, love, love Rush. So fitting everything to about why Rush is so wonderful into an hour is a travesty. So this is why we got an extended show for you guys tonight. Probably only going to be about like 15 minutes, maybe half an hour, but I don't really care about the hour limit right now. We're just going to go as long as we can. But let's get to it. Now that that's out of my system, though, Rush was formed in August 1968 in Toronto, Canada, by bassist and vocalist Jeff Jones, drummer John Retzi, and guitarist Alex Lifeson. In this edition of Where Did the Band Get Their Name? Retzi's older brother suggested Rush right before the band's first gig at a coffee shop inside the basement of an old Anglican church. It was a joke on the band members rushing to come up with a name for the band. Ha ha ha, how so funny. It's actually the lamest story I've ever heard for rock and roll band names. But, I mean, at least it sounds cool. Jeff Jones didn't last very long in the band, though, and he was replaced by the local Jewish kid that Lifeson was good friends with, Gary Lee Weinrib. The son of Polish Holocaust survivors, his mother would retain her heavy Polish accent, and Gary would come out to sound like Getty. Thus, the boy liked to be referred to as Getty Lee, and there was no turning back. It's actually his legal name now. He had it changed about 30, 40 years later after the incident. But Getty becomes the bassist and lead vocalist, and the lineup changes would just keep coming in like a hurricane. We're going to start with January 1969. Lifeson requested keyboardist and guitarist vocalist Guy Lindy Young for the band, and in that May, Getty Lee was kicked out. What? Well, he prompted Lee to form his own band, Judd. He was replaced by bassist vocalist Joe Perna, and the band name at this point was called Hadrian. Yeah, are we keeping tabs here? Well, I mean, it's pretty trippy right now. But Judd was super successful in the Toronto music scene, anyway, that Lindy Young wanted in on the band, and he just, you know, ditched Hadrian at this point, and he was like, I want to join your band. And Getty was like, okay. Well, this whole shebang lasted until September, when Judd broke up and Rush comes back from the dead with the lineup of Getty Lee on bass and vocals, Alex Lifeson on guitar, and John Retzi on drums. Now we can commence with Rush, the band that I'm going to be talking about tonight. The band first started out playing covers of their idols, The Who, Led Zeppelin, Cream, and Jimi Hendrix, to name a few. They also wrote original songs, although they never appeared on their future albums, such as Keep in Line and Garden Road. Actually, if you want to look these up on YouTube and listen to them, it sounds like Zeppelin with shrieking vocals. Well, yeah, that's Rush. Well, for now, anyway. Rush wouldn't release their first single until 1973, which is Buddy Holly's Not Fade Away, with the original You Can't Fight It on the B-side. The single wasn't too hot. In fact, multiple record companies disregarded Rush entirely. They didn't like their sound. So, as a result, the band created their own label, Moon Records, and released their eponymous debut album in March 1974. This is the one Rush album that sounds absolutely nothing like the others, and you're going to find out why in a minute. They basically sound like the Canadian Led Zeppelin. But Rush was only seeing local success until a radio station in Cleveland, Ohio, WMMS, came across the album. WMMS DJ and station manager Donna Halper played the 7-minute long Working Man, and the fans love it. I've actually talked to Donna Halper before on Facebook. A bunch of Rush fans like myself back in the day requested to be friends with her on Facebook, and she accepted all of us, and we used to have nice conversations about Rush, and she would just talk all of them. She's still a big supporter of the band, and I I think she talks to them like once in a while, but they definitely credit her for their big success in the United States and the reason why they even exist today. But yeah, she's really nice and really cool. We love Donna in the Rush fandom. But anyway, Working Man, the song, reflected the blue-collar area so well, plus that Zeppelin sound was just super popular in the early 70s, that Rush immediately gained a following in the United States. And until now, like, their biggest following, I would have to say, is in the Midwest, but, I mean, they're popular in general in the United States all around. The album was redistributed on Mercury Records, and Rush was on the map. I'm gonna play you a song off of this album, the opening track, Finding My Way. You'll hear what I mean when I say this album really sticks out from the rest of Rush's works. But hey, the band was merely finding their way. Now, on with that bad pun, take a listen to Finding My Way on Penguin Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is DJ Trouble, and you're listening to Let's Rock and Roll on Penguin Radio. This hour, we're listening to the Canadian Led Zeppelin. No, just kidding. It's Rush. But although this album was super popular at the time of its release, Rush, the album, isn't seen as favorably now. And by favorably now, I mean I actually hate this album. Well, okay, hate is a strong word. Strongly dislike compared to the rest of their works is how I describe it. It's not really one of my favorite albums, only because their lyrics are kind of subpar on this one, and it just sounds like Zeppelin. It's nothing really out of the ordinary, and, well, I mean, not to mention when we get on with the show, if I ever, stop stuttering. But the band really drastically changed right after John Rutsey quits the band due to his dislike of touring and his battle with diabetes. This is where it really changes. So Rush replaces him with drummer Neil Peart on July 29th, 1974. Also Geddy Lee's 21st birthday, because you definitely needed to know that. But before joining the band, Peart lived in London to advance his musical career, but he found no success, so he got really depressed and returned to Canada, and he auditioned for Rush, and he instantly won the job because he pretty much killed it. However, Alex Lifeson didn't like him at first as a person, but Geddy Lee, adored Peart, and he convinced Alex to accept him as part of the band because where else are you going to find a better drummer than him? So he's like, all right, fine. Luckily, he did change his mind. And now we got the real Rush, and now it's going to get interesting. Peart literally changed the game for Rush, beginning with their second album, Fly By Night, released in 1975. Peart became the main lyricist for the band, and the songs suddenly became literally works of art in contrast to their last album, which is why I don't really like their first album, because Fly By Night is it's a really good album. I like it. One of the main reasons I do love Rush, though, is that their lyrics are amazing and they do tell stories and they have such intellect with them. And all that credit belongs to Neil Peart. Fantasy themes show up on Fly By Night, including Bytor and the Snow Dog and Rivendell, which is a nod to J.R.R. Tolkien. Ayn Rand was an inspiration on the opening track, Anthem. She would be the main influence on their future album, 2112. But later in 1975, Rush releases their third album, Caress of Steel, which is a ballsy, ballsy album. This is also the first album of theirs to contain a song taking over the entirety of a side. The Fountain of Lamneth is 20 minutes, and the only song on side two of this album. It's actually kind of a cool, really weird song, and this is just a weird album in general. But while Fly By Night displayed progress for Rush, Caress of Steel was a drastic setback in terms of sales for the band. There's just such long pieces on this album. Their songs are just so long, and not many songs actually made it onto their live sets, except for Bastille Day, which is like this really kind of cool song. I mean, just listen to it. But the band definitely establishes themselves as a strictly progressive hard rock band at this point. They're no longer the Canadian Led Zeppelin. They're, well, Rush. But Rush was almost kicked off their record label due to the fewer copies sold than Fly By Night. It's their weirdest album, but it's not a bad album. If you're like a hardcore Rush fan and you really appreciate 70s Rush, you'll like this album. 70s Rush is a great period for the band, and this is definitely a contributor to their heavier period. And so that's mainly why Rush is so loved. But fun fact about the album cover, it's originally supposed to be printed in a silver color to give it a steel appearance. However, it turned out gold. Printing errors. Well, actually, that error wasn't reversed. So now when you pick up a copy of Caress of Steel and it looks gold and you're like, well, this doesn't make sense. That's why. Even Geddy Lee admits this album was really weird. He literally said he thought the band was pretty high during the making of Caress of Steel. That definitely is a observation that is, well, correct on when you listen to the album. But Rush was feeling the effects of their dwindling audience, especially during their promotional tour, hilariously dubbed the Down the Tubes Tour. This frustrated the band enough for their next album to adopt a go big or go home attitude, and we enter into 2112. The record companies wanted Rush to sound more commercial for their next album, go back to their Zeppelin roots. But they're like, nope, we're going to make the music we want to make, and we don't give a crap if we go unemployed at this point. We're going to make something we're proud of. So it really pays off, and the fourth album was released in 1976. It features the 7-part, 20.5-minute title track, 2112, depicting a dystopian story set in a year, take a guess, 2112. Critically, it's an amazing album. I personally don't like it as much, only because after 2112, the song, which is an amazing song that really hypes you up, and you're like, wow, this is so great, what did I just listen to? The rest of the songs, except for Tears and Something for Nothing, they're kind of a little unnecessary, and they kind of just fall apart. It's kind of like 2112, it stands alone, and then the rest are kind of just filler songs. But, however, we all like it because it saved Rush from obscurity, and it rocks so hard. It's so great to see this song live, too. But after the success of 2112, Rush releases their first live album, All the World's a Stage, encompassing how far they've come at this point. All glory to Neil Peart for joining this band. But after 2112, Rush followed up with their fifth album, A Farewell to Kings, released in 1977. At this point, we're getting more prog up in here. Lots and lots of different instruments, double-neck guitars. It's getting pretty awesome up in here. Farewell to Kings would be Rush's first album to go gold, and eventually platinum in the U.S. I really love this album. This is a good album to listen to, especially if you're first getting into Rush and you want to know about this odd period of theirs. Well, not odd, just very quintessential 70s hard rock period. This is the album to listen to. Geddy Lee's vocals are at an all-time high in the octave, so you definitely hear the screeching. And oh my god, that singer sounds like a girl. See, she can sing really well. You have no idea how many times I've heard that. Whatever. But the bass is also incredible. Alex Lifeson's guitar riffs are so inventive and awesome, and he does not get enough credit in this band. But Neil also kills it on drums, and it's absolutely legendary. The band begins to use more instruments, such as synthesizers. Very little, though. Wait another decade, and we'll definitely talk about the synths. They use double-neck guitars, and Neil's percussion kit included triangles, glockenspiel, wood blocks, cowbells, gong, and chimes. And he knew how to play all of them. Well, I should hope so. I don't know why I just said that, but it's just so awesome. I'm getting really excited. But the next song you're going to hear is off of Farewell to Kings, and it's one of the rare Rush songs under 3 minutes, Closer to the Heart. One of the band's most popular songs, the band got really sick of performing it in the 2000s because it was such a popular song. And they were like, ugh, we're just so tired of playing this. We want to play some other songs. So screw Closer to the Heart, which made me sad because that's one of my favorite songs. But it has returned for their most recent tours, and that just makes me all sorts of happy. Well, enjoy it. It's a really great song. You're listening to Closer to the Heart on Penguin Radio, listening to Let's Rock and Roll.
Philosophers and plowmen, each must know his part.
Welcome back to Let's Rock and Roll on Penguin Radio. I'm your host, DJ Trouble. A Farewell to Kings is the beginning of my personal favorite era of Rush, 1977 to 1982. Although this period is their most commercially successful, it's where they created their best music, so obviously why wouldn't they be successful? Rush released their sixth album, Hemispheres, in 1978. This album is pretty much a continuation of A Farewell to Kings, but on steroids, and so prog you can't even handle it. Along with Peart's elaborate percussion kit, Gailey begins to incorporate bass pedal synthesizers and mini Moog, while Alex Lifeson experimented with 6 and 12 string acoustic guitars. Basically, the more instruments, the better. The songs are still incredibly long on Hemispheres. The duology Cygnus X1 appears on both albums. Book 1 is the last track on A Farewell to Kings, and it is so badass. And book 2, Hemispheres, appears on the opening track of Hemispheres. And that's about 18 minutes. And it's like, yeah, okay, this is really long. Oh my god, this song isn't over yet? Oh wait, what just happened? That just sounds really cool. So, yeah, you kind of stick it out a little bit. But book 2 is the last one-sided song Rush would ever have. The lyrics got even more nerdy, to say the least, with influences of poetry, fantasy, literature, science fiction, and a whole lot of Ayn Rand. A side note about Rush's songs influenced by Rand. Rush were being accused of being right-wing extremists by music critics, especially in the 70s, where being right-wing was shameful. That revitalization wouldn't come back until Reagan became president in the 80s. But as also in the 70s, especially Rolling Stone magazine, anyone would find an excuse to hate Rush because they were just, well, different, and they were good different. So they were like, no, we want more commercial stuff. We don't like this Rush crap. But actually, in 2010, to kind of go back to the right-wing thing, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul used The Trees off of Hemispheres as his campaign song for when he was running for senator back in, well, when he was campaigning. And The Trees is actually about kind of how the oaks and the maples wouldn't get along and how, like, the maples scream oppression and the oaks just shake their heads. That's it. That's a lyric straight out of the song. And it's kind of about, like, two people not getting along and one feels oppressed by the other. So they're like, oh, we need to be free. So Rand Paul kind of takes this as a libertarian anthem. And he's like, oh, it stands for how the government needs to be less like the oak and more like the maple. They need to fall and stand in their place of the human being or whatever. But Rush, especially Neil Peart, didn't want anything to do with the campaign, nor the Republican Party in general, so they actually forbade him to use any of their music or any of his campaigning ever. And so he's like, well, whatever, I still like your music, and you're still libertarian gods, whatever. And, you know, he's currently running for president, woohoo! But the band members themselves don't make their political views public, except for Peart, who used to call himself a libertarian, until a recent interview of him criticizing the GOP for their oppressive views on human rights and tarnishing the Republican Party. And so he was like, no, that's complete crap. That's not the way I want to see politics go down. But, okay, I don't care if their views fall on the right of the political spectrum. They make great music that harms no one. So I'm still going to listen to Rush. That's like Ted Nugent. He's like a huge, like, proponent of the Second Amendment. He's a big right-wing guy. But, I mean, he's still the Motor City Madman. I'm still going to listen to his music because his music is awesome. I don't give a crap about his political views. But, collectively, the band agreed they were done with the long song format. Yes, we're going to get back to the music now. Enough politics, more music. But, long song format. This affected their radio airplay, and they kind of wanted to be a teeny bit more popular on the radio, just a little bit. I mean, I guess when the music critics kind of really hate you, you want to slightly reverse it while still doing your own thing. So the band began to record their seventh album, Permanent Waves, in 1979, and Rush began to create shorter songs while remaining their complex and progressive selves. The turn of the decade brought new trends in music, such as new wave and reggae. And Rush took it and made it their own. Permanent Waves was released in 1980, and two radio hits, The Spirit of Radio, tonight's intro song, and Free Will, continue to play on classic rock radio to this day. And they're super popular songs in concert, too. And the songs were still relatively long, about 5 to 6 minutes, because this is Rush we're talking about, and the lyrics shifted from science fiction to social commentary. A great improvement, in my personal opinion. The lyrics definitely got better as time went on. Permanent Waste was set up for Rush's most successful album, 1981's Moving Pictures. You got two songs that everyone knows, Tom Sawyer and Limelight. Tom Sawyer was actually parodied by South Park in 2008. Definitely look that up because it's very, very funny. Well, the creators of the show, Trey Parker and Matt Stone, are huge Rush fans, so they kind of have to pay homage to their favorite band sometime. But no, it's really funny. Please look it up. Rush actually used it in one of their intros on their Snakes and Arrows tour in 2008 when they were introducing Tom Sawyer. So they all took it in good fun. But turn on any classic rock radio station and you're going to hear either Tom Sawyer or Limelight. And, of course, there is my slight rule that I like to bend sometimes, but not today. My slight rule that I never play super popular songs on here, so if that's why you're tuned in to just hear some Limelight, yeah, you're going to be a little bit disappointed. But don't be too distraught, because in a moment, you're going to hear a great song off of Moving Pictures, the instrumental YYZ. YYZ is the airport identification code for Toronto Pearson International Airport, the hometown airport of, well, Rush. One time, Alex Lyson flew them into the airport. Yes, he's a certified pilot. He can fly planes. How cool is that? But, and the band heard the rhythm as they arrived. The rhythm is actually YYZ in Morse code, which is, well, you'll hear it. I can't actually replicate it. The rhythm stuck with Peart and Lee, and they decided to turn it into a song. It's in 5/4 time signature, and the beginning repeats the Morse code rhythm in multiple musical arrangements. It's super catchy and a lot of fun to see and jam to live. I'm going to give you YYZ on Let's Rock and Roll with DJ Treble on radio.dominican.edu.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Let's Rock and Roll. We're going to pause for a brief station identification here. This is Penguin Radio on radio.dominican.edu, the official radio station of Dominican University of California. Currently, you are listening to Let's Rock and Roll, and I'm your host, DJ Treble. I really hope you're enjoying this hour all about Rush. I know I'm having the time of my life right now talking about my favorite band. Well, a little bit more about Moving Pictures before we move on. It was the last album to feature a Rush song longer than 10 minutes, The Camera Eye, which is a really, really cool song that kind of sets in New York City and then goes into London. And it's pretty cool with its sound effects. The use of synthesizers was growing as well, undergoing another musical transition for Rush. Moving Pictures went quadruple platinum, and the tour for the album was comprised into their second live album, Exit Stage Left, which is my personal favorite live album of theirs, in 1981. But for now, we enter the period lovingly referred to by Rush fans as the Geddy Lee treats synthesizers like he's addicted to heroin phase, aka the 80s, which is slightly ironic because the 80s is all about cocaine, but whatever, we're not here for the drug references, you're here for the music. The first album of this period is 1982's Signals. I love this album. This is probably, and I say this a lot, this is my favorite album. We're just going to say it. No, this is my favorite album. It's set in stone. Mark my word, favorite album. Synthesizers became the focal point in their songs, especially Subdivisions, the most relatable song lyrically that will ever exist. If you're a kid like me who grew up in the suburbs and you felt like you stuck out, then, well, yeah, you're pretty much Neil Peart, Geddy Lee, and Alex Lifeson growing up in the suburbs and sticking out. This is your anthem, and it was definitely my anthem. It was definitely the song that got me into Rush, too, like, big time in, well, 8th grade, because middle school. But, I mean, this is an important song for me. But, as a consequence, Alex Lifeson does not get as much of a prominent guitar time. Mixed results about this. Lifeson was and is a tragically underrated guitarist already, so many Rush fans weren't happy with the lack of guitar on the new album. Other fans, like myself, still think Rush could pull out synthesizers better than anyone else could, so let's enjoy it in the meantime. In the 70s, Rush's influences were Zeppelin and The Who. In the 80s, the influences were The Police and U2. The musicality becomes a lot more diverse, with genres such as ska, reggae, and funk. The new direction worked on Signals, and I'm just going to talk about Signals for a little bit more. They have some amazing, amazing songs on this album. And this is also Neil kind of stated that the lyrics in Signals were the lyrics where he realized that people were actually relating to them, and so he definitely felt that honor to an extent. So I definitely think Rush became a lot more aware of what they were doing, and it was definitely prevalent on Signals. So that's another album I highly recommend for Rush fans to listen to. So actually, we got three. We got A Farewell to Kings, we got Moving Pictures, obviously, and we got Signals. Also, add in Permanent Waves and 2112, and you're good. You're pretty much good. That's your starter kit. But we're going to talk about their next album, 1984's Grace Under Pressure. This is another great, great album of theirs. Peart begins to use electronic drums and percussion on this album to complement Lee's massive kit of synthesizers, and Lifeson's guitar is put even further on the back burner. He does get some great guitar solos on certain songs of Grace Under Pressure, such as Red Sector A, The Enemy Within, Distant Early Warning, etc. Lyrically, Rush got more political, with Distant Early Warning talking about anti-nuclear war, and Red Sector A being an autobiographical song about Lee's family experience in the Holocaust. Another really poignant song on this album is After Image, which is basically mourning a death of someone who died too early. So that also tugs my heartstrings a little bit. While the themes vary from one album to another, Peart still knows how to write poetic lines incorporated with brilliant music. Yeah, Blender Magazine actually gives him some hate. They called him the second worst lyricist of all time. And everyone else on this planet, literally everyone on the planet, thinks that's just a load of crap. Musically, the synthesizers started to become way too much with 1985's Power Windows. Rush surrounded themselves less with metal and more with MTV. Their music videos for Big Money and Mystic Rhythms were incredibly cheesy and totally 80s. Same with Distant Early Warning, to be honest. They're just... Geddy Lee's hair, if you see the music videos, he kind of has, like, the raccoon hat look going. It's not pretty. It's just not good. And just... Oh, it's so 80s. It's embarrassing, really. But, I mean, it brought the band a new fan base, a more commercial fan base, actually, apart from their longtime prog rock fans. I'm going to play you a song off this album to show you exactly what I mean. Emotion Detector. Lyrically, it's fantastic, so I definitely recommend this song. So, let's just focus on the lyrical part, because the synthesizers, you'll hear it enough. They're prominent enough. Sit back and listen to Emotion Detector, only on Let's Rock and Roll with DJ Trouble on radio.dominican.edu. Welcome back to Let's Rock and Roll with DJ Treble. This hour, we've been talking and listening all about Rush. Now I've waited until the very bitter end to talk about this band. And can I just, I don't know if I mentioned this, but yes, I have. I'm thrilled that this day has finally arrived. I forgot to mention, actually, a key component about the change in Rush's kind of style of music. Geddy Lee, as you literally just noted for the past 5-6 minutes of that song, his vocal range definitely decreased an octave. He doesn't go with the shrieking high vocals anymore, and he definitely decided to do that because he didn't want to strain out his vocals anymore. So he was like, no, let me just sing at a lower octave and see how it goes. And it obviously works out for him. He can't really hit the high notes anymore, but he's still killing it. But Rush's last album of this awkward synthesizer phase is almost over, and it ends with 1987's Hold Your Fire. I admit, this is the one Rush album I have not listened to in its entirety, nor do I actually anticipate on doing that. A few songs are good off this album, Force 10, Mission, and my personal favorite, Time Stand Still. Actually, quick note about Time Stand Still. This song was the song I listened to the night before my high school graduation and the night before I left for college. I cried both times like a baby. I didn't want to grow up, and that's exactly what the song is about. Well, the album, however, didn't sell as well as their past albums, Only Going Gold. Only Going Gold! Alex Lifeson was getting pretty pissed that Geddy Lee's bass and synths were the primary instrument, while his guitar was secondary. Geddy had to quit the heroin, the metaphorical type, the synths. You guys remember that, right? He's not a drug addict, you guys. Just cool it. First step, switch record labels from Mercury to Atlantic in 1989. Second step, release a third live album, A Show of Hands, to instigate the end of this period. Third step, and the final step, return to your guitar-oriented sound. 1989's Presto was the starting point of the guitar as the focal point. Yay, more Lifeson on guitar, woohoo! Some of the songs on this album, though, had a piano line, Red Tide, Available Light, but nothing, like, crazy with the synthesizers. The Rush trademark of diverse musical genres is prevalent here as well, with the opening track Show Don't Tell mixing funk and pop rock and scars with the tribal drum pattern and rhythm. More musical diversity appears on the 1991 album Roll the Bones. I'll give you an example of this new direction with the title track Roll the Bones. One of my all-time favorites, this song reflects on taking chances in life. Rolling the bones equals rolling the dice. In terms of my personal beliefs, this song is also an existential song, saying that life is slightly absurd anyway, and there's really not much in our control of why we're here or how, or even where we go after death, because, you know, people believe that there is an afterlife after death, and they kind of worry about, oh, what's going to happen when I die? Will I go to heaven? I'm kind of like, well, I mean, we're going to die anyway, so why worry? You might as well live and just take the chances and live a life that you're happy with and just do whatever that makes you happy. Also, beware, there's a hilarious rap by Geddy Lee, altered voice of course, that just makes this song entirely wonderful and just so easy to laugh at. So get out there and rock and roll the bones. Take a listen to it on Let's Rock and Roll with DJ Treble here on Penguin Radio.
You can stick that game. Good work is the key to good fortune. Winners take that praise, losers seldom take that blame. If they don't take that game, and sometimes a winner takes nothing, we draw our own designs, fortune has to make that blame. Way that lady died. happen.
Bet your butt I was jamming out to that song. Rock and Rollers, glad to have you back on Let's Rock and Roll with the one and only DJ Treble. We're well into the 90s history of Rush, leaving off at Roll the Bones. At this point, synthesizers were not even a thing anymore in their music, transitioning into their 1993 album counterparts. I really like this album because it sounds like 70s Rush all grown up. It's super guitar heavy, maybe one of their heaviest albums. It just rocks. Lyrically, it deals with emotional themes, especially the song Nobody's Hero. I highly recommend this song if you want to feel emotions you never knew you could feel. This new direction also made into their next album, 1996's Test for Echo. Not nearly as good as counterparts, but something important to know about Neil Peart going into the production of this album. Wanting to enhance his drumming expertise, already one of the best drummers of all time, and he still aspires to continue to improve. How amazing. Well, Peart seeks out the wisdom from longtime jazz instructor Freddie Gruber, who helped him reinvent Peart's drumming style with incorporating jazz and swing training. Since then, Peart has stuck with this method of playing. Also since Test for Echo, the Test for Echo tour, Rush has toured without an opening act, which means over 3 hours of Rush. Yes! In fact, the tickets from this tour read, "An Evening with Rush." The Test for Echo tour also witnessed the only occurrence when the 20-minute epic 2112 was performed in its entirety. Rush fans love it, and the band is back on top of their game until tragedy actually hits them the following year. 1997, they were pretty big on their game, but the band actually decides to take a 5-year hiatus, and that is because Neil Peart, he deals with some pretty bad tragedy in his life. In August 1997, his teenage daughter, Selena, dies in a car accident, just kind of out of nowhere, really. And then, less than a year later, his wife, Jacqueline, dies from breast cancer. So, Neil Peart is all depressed and just absolutely hates his life. I mean, I would too. You lost your wife and daughter within a year. That's just terrible. But he actually, what he did, he pretty much avoided his entire life, and he embarked on his self-described healing journey by motorcycle, in which he traveled thousands of miles across North America. And he actually turned this into a book, like a book about his travels. It's called Ghost Rider, Travels on the Healing Road. I own this book, and the first time I read it, I absolutely cried because Neil went super in depth about his depression and kind of his hatred for life, and you really got to kind of learn the genius behind the lyrics, like, as a human being. And that definitely hit a little soft spot for me. So definitely go out and buy this book and read it, because you will love it. And you'll actually feel so much for Neil Peart and respect him so much more as a person. But Rush actually later stated they almost broke up during this because Neil was just such in a terrible situation. Music really wasn't important at this point. However, the only thing that kind of the public got in terms of anything new to buy from Rush is basically a triple CD live album called Different Stages, which contains like two disc package pretty much from their counterparts and Test for Echo tours. And then the third album is kind of like never before heard performances from their concert in London from their Farewell to Kings tour. And so it was dedicated in loving memory to Selena and Jacqueline. Also, during this hiatus, Geddy Lee releases his solo album, My Favorite Headache, in November 2000. Yeah, I own this album, and I actually like it, because it's kind of refreshing to hear Geddy Lee create his own music. And, like, lyrically, he got way better as compared to 1974. But, I mean, it's not, like, tier one, A+, Dark Side of the Moon stuff. I mean, it's no Moving Pictures, but it's pretty good. But after, like, 5 years to grieve and kind of get his life together as a means of lack of kind of subtle words to say it, Neil Peart actually marries photographer Carrie Nuttall in September 2000, which in the end of Ghost Rider, he does mention her and how he fell in love with her and everything. It's so sweet. So in early 2001, he actually announced to his bandmates that, yeah, I'm ready to go back in the studio. I'm ready to make some music again. And so fans were like, yes, oh my god, he's still alive. Rush is going to make more music. Yes. So the band returns in May 2002 with, oddly enough, a very heavy sounding album, because I think they just wanted to just put everything into this album. It's 2002's Vapor Trails. So, and this is kind of their comeback album. So the opening track of the album starts out with this booming, booming drum, and it's called One Little Victory. And is basically just to really grab your attention. It's like, yeah, we're back. So, but it's really, really heavy. But I mean, it also sounds really poppy and sounds kind of just like your basic rock and roll album. Oddly enough, in general, it's not their best album. Actually, I consider it their worst album. And we're talking at the likes of Test for Echo and Caress of Steel here. That's only because, I mean, it was their, I do commend it because it is their comeback album. So, I appreciate it on that point. And this does not include any synthesizers, organs, or keyboards since the early 1970s. This is 100% guitar-driven. It actually doesn't have any guitar solos, though. It just kind of sounds like a string of songs kind of strung together. It's definitely, if anything, it's more lyrically driven. Because Alex Lifeson was kind of like, well, I think the lyrics should really give it more prominence, and I shouldn't really be in the spotlight so much because this is really all about Neil right now and kind of the mood of the album. It's more like Neil trying to survive, so let's give him the light instead and really kind of give him the lyrical standpoint. So lyrically, this has a lot of contrasting feelings, which is exactly what he was feeling during the grieving process. So there's like some warm optimism and just really icy despair and hatred for life. So it's definitely a Neil Peart album. So if anything, lyrically and just, oh, it's such an amazing album. This is actually their longest time spent on an album, 14 months. They usually never spend this long time. But the album debuted to, well, moderate praise. They're like, all right, cool. They're back. We're going to appreciate it. But it's not a great album. But the band's first tour in 6 years. They were huge, especially they performed the first time in Mexico City and Brazil, which is where they recorded Rush in Rio, and it just played some large, large crowds. But I'm going to give you a little taste of that comeback album. It's a song called Ghost Rider, and it's definitely, obviously, an autobiographical song about Neil Peart, but I listened to this about 3 times before I started the show, so it's in my head, and I really love this song. It's my favorite off the album, so take a listen to Ghost Rider only on Let's Rock and Roll with DJ Trouble on Penguin Radio. Mm-hmm. wrapping things up on this final installment of Let's Rock and Roll with DJ Treble. We're just going to leave off with Russian Rio, released in late October 2003. It was a triple CD live album and dual DVD, and it's the full concert performance of their Last Night on the Vapor Trails tour, which was recorded on November 2002 at the Macarena Stadium in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. This is by far, like, this is actually their second largest crowd that Rush has ever played of in front of, like, of all time, 40,000 people. And their previous night in Sao Paulo was a capacity of 60,000. This is absolutely insane to see 40,000 people just screaming for Rush. And they are also taken aback, too. This is also starting when kind of noticing some characteristics about their further tours. Neil Peart always delivers an amazing drum solo. And even in kind of recent performances of one of their big songs, La Via Stranjato, Alex Lifeson will go on like a miniature rant for about... long as it's about 8 minutes, typically 3 to 4. And it's just him just rambling about things. And it's because he's so funny. So that's always kind of little quirks that you see at Rush concerts that we as Rush fans kind of embrace. But drum solos, Neil Peart, big thing. He even got nominated for a Grammy for one of his in 2004, but he lost to Brian Wilson. So, I mean, okay, I see how it is. But 2004, we're now celebrating their 30th anniversary as a band. So Rush releases Feedback, which is an album that pretty much had them playing covers of The Who, Cream, and Yardbirds. So, which obviously they cited as their biggest influences as a band. So they paid homage to them, and it's actually pretty cool. But also, we get a little bit of R30, which is something they released in 2004. And it was their concert in Frankfurt, Germany, kind of celebrating their 30 years as a band. And yeah, it's pretty cool. They've also done, obviously, a bunch of concerts since. They've re-released some albums, including like a 3, like VHS video sort of thing of Exit Stage Left, Grace Under Pressure, and a Show of Hands tour, just to kind of get the fans something really cool to see. They released their 18th album, Snakes and Arrows, in 2007. And it follows with a huge tour. So, and then I actually didn't get to see this. This is around the time I got into Rush. And right after I got into Rush, the tour happened. So I was like, oh, crap. Oh, well. Anyway, so that does happen. I didn't get to see Rush live until 2011 when they did their Time Machine tour. Not the first leg, which they started in the fall of 2009. And after they took like kind of a hiatus of sorts. And then in 2010, they were like, nah, we want to go on tour. So Time Machine Tour happens. So that happens during the summer of 2010 to 2011. And then, well, the second leg was in 2010. And then, first leg was in 2010. I don't know why I'm losing my train of thought right now. I'm just, I'm paralyzed with so many memories of Rush. But second leg happens in 2011. And it was June 26, 2011 in Concord, California. I saw Rush for the very first time when I was 14 years old. I was a dorky looking 14 year old. And I was pretty much the only one under 35 surrounding me there. But it was super duper fun to see them live. It was at the, I don't remember the name of the amphitheater now, but it's the one in Concord. It's that little pavilion. It's so, so cool. Yes, that was really fun. And then, actually, in 2012, they released their latest album, Clockwork Angels. So, they released that album, and they go on tour for it. And, of course, I missed this tour, because this was in the fall, and the closest they were L.A., and I had a really, really big final around that time, not to mention a cross-country meet. So, I couldn't go, and I was very upset. But Clockwork Angels is definitely a heavy, heavy, heavy album that I've only listened to once in its entirety. I can't really say I know quite a few songs off the album except BU2B or Brought Up to Believe, which rocks really hard. And my favorite song is Caravan, because there's a really sweet little motto in there. It's in a world where I feel so small, I can't stop thinking big. And that's something that's kind of carried me through life in general these past few years. So that's kind of it for Rush now. And the latest they've done is their last big, big tour was their R40 tour, which is celebrating 40 years as a band. Can't really believe it, but they killed it. This started in May of 2015 and it ended in August. The concert I attended was in San Jose on July 23rd, 2015. And oh my God, it was at the SAP Center where the Sharks play. And it really brought me to kind of that 70s arena rock feel. And I just had the time of my life there. I had such a ridiculous amount of fun. It was insane. So that kind of rounds up on what Rush is doing. As of now, they're kind of just like, well, we're done with the big, large tours such as this one because we're getting old. Alex Lyson actually has some health problems of his own, along with Neil Peart. Geddy Lee's kind of the only one who's like in shape and in perfect health at their age of the early 60s. But, I mean, Lyson did not rule out smaller tours and or playing like limited nights of sorts at big events, so I'm pretty sure we'll have some Rush concerts in the future. It's just, it's not going to happen on a large scale like this. But I'm really happy I've got to see this band twice live. I feel so incredibly lucky to see them live. So I'm so thrilled. I love this band more than life. So, well, not more than life, but this band has really gotten me through a lot. So I'm so grateful for them. And I'm so grateful I got to share my love for Rush for you and classic rock in general these past 10 weeks. So this concludes tonight's show, and for the rest of the semester, really. I may or may not come back next semester with 10 new bands, maybe even a theme to go along with it. I just have to work some stuff out, but I'm super grateful for Penguin Radio for giving me this opportunity to give me my radio show, even though this is actually a requirement for the internet radio class. Oops. Anyway, I wouldn't be able to do this at, you know, any other college, so shout out to Dominican and for allowing me to do this and just really kind of encouraging my creativity, because I just love talking about this band, so, and these bands in general. So if anything, I've had the time of my life this semester, and I'm so grateful to bring you all some great classic rock every Monday night. So that's the conclusion of tonight's show. Don't forget to check out all of our other DJs at rio.dominican.edu, as well as some sports broadcasts on Penguin Radio. We're pretty good at that sort of thing. We're always a treat to listen to. So, but I really hope you enjoyed this hour about Rush tonight, and I've hoped you enjoyed all the 10 hours that we've spent together listening to all the bands. The Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Jimi Hendrix, Fleetwood Mac, Pink Floyd, The Who, The Doors, Queen, Led Zeppelin, and the one and only Rush. It's been a great ride. I hope I can come back and deliver 10 more bands. But if not, I love this so much. I love all you guys for listening. For now, this is going to be DJ Trouble signing off with The Analog Kid, my all-time favorite Rush song. And yeah, I'm so happy and grateful. And I wish you all the happiest of holidays and all the good life. So this is Penguin Radio at radio.dominican.edu, the official station of Dominican University of California. Go Penguins!
Guess not.